This is an ABC podcast.
I would have been maybe six or seven, and we were watching Ned Kelly on television.
It's the early 1970s. We're in a living room in Cairns in far north Queensland, watching a Ned Kelly movie on TV.
Friends, let's drink to it. To the Republic of Victoria.
Mick Jagger is playing the lead role.
Oh, the falling out of the Rolling Stones played Ned Kelly.
This is Gullin Gullina Elwood, but most people call her Cal.
I grew up in Cairns, been following family history nearly all my life.
The movie sparked Cal's interest in family history. Because on her TV, she saw a group of Aboriginal policemen sitting proudly on their horses.
These men can track the gallop, Commissioner. They can pick up signs no white man can see.
Dad told me and my brother and that. He said, you know, one of them black fellas there is my great-grandfather, he said. And so that's when I first heard about that my great-great-grandfather was actually an Aboriginal policeman.
He was a trooper in Queensland's Native Police and one of five Aboriginal troopers present at Ned Kelly's infamous last stand.
After that, we'd always ask him about Ned Kelly and about our great-great-grandfather being a policeman and was sent down there. It wasn't until much later that I realised what the Native Police got up to. We were never told about that they actually shot blackfellas.
Hello, I'm Daniel Browning, and this is The History Listen. Over the next two episodes, we're looking at the impact of Queensland's Native Mounted Police, which ran from the late 1840s to about 1904. Its purpose was to protect white settlers on the frontier, and it was notorious for its violence against Indigenous people. If that wasn't enough, the troopers in the Native Police were Indigenous men themselves. Georgia Moody takes us to far north Queensland to see how descendants of Native Police troopers and descendants of massacre survivors make sense of this history.
When she was growing up in Cairns, Cal heard stories about massacres that happened to Indigenous people on the colonial frontier.
I learnt most of it just growing up black, and you'd hear the old people tell us about these stories.
But it wasn't until high school that she connected those stories with her own great-great-grandfather, the one she learnt about watching that Ned Kelly movie on TV.
I was a good one for wagging school, and I'd disappear down to the Cairns Esplanade or out to the fringe camps, and I'd talk to all the old people, and they would used to talk about how the Aboriginal policemen used to come out all the time and round them up or shoot them. And one of them actually spoke about his grandfather being shot by the Aboriginal policemen. And then that got me curious some more, so I went to the library at the school and found Henry Reynolds' book.
The book was The Other Side of the Frontier, the groundbreaking history about frontier violence.
And then I read it. It was pretty heavy reading, I guess. And like all young Aboriginal people, we seem to get up on that soapbox when we're, you know, 16, 17, 18, and, you know, we hate the world. We hate all white people. Well, I went through that just like most other Aboriginal people.
And it's easy to understand Cal's reaction when you learn about the history of the Native Police. I'm in Cooktown, about 4 hours north of where Cal lives in Cairns.
So a lot of the police camps, the Native Mounted Police camps, they always... Yeah, they always sort of set the police camps.
I'm in the car with two archaeologists. Linley?
My name is Linley Wallace and I'm a Senior Research Fellow in the Nulungu Research Institute at the University of Notre Dame, Australia.
And Bryce?
I'm Professor Bryce Barker from the University of Southern Queensland.
Like me, Linley and Bryce are both white. For almost 4 years, they've been leading a huge research project on Queensland's Native Police. As well as archival research and oral history interviews, their team has done major archaeological digs on former police camps. Because what's in the ground is important to this story. More on that later.
Cart Road closed. Okay, great.
Right now, we're heading to an old police camp called 8 Mile.
According to the map, this looks good, but we have to follow it all the way north for a bit. Yep.
Even though we're just 15 minutes from Cooktown, it feels pretty isolated out here. We're on a dirt road, surrounded on both sides by dense bushland.
Nice big wetland here.
Yep, I'm sure there's a croc in there for us.
Beautiful lily pads on there.
Probably the water hole for the police camp.
The water hole, and I think it comes to an end.
It does, yeah, give way here. So then turn left and it's on your right. We are absolutely in vicinity.
We could maybe just sit
here.
Here. On that log. How do you guys feel about that?
Sure. Looks lovely.
Okay.
This is one of just under 200 police camps that we know of across Queensland.
This is the approximate location of the what was known as the 8 Mile Native Mounted Police Camp, so called that because it was about 8 miles out of Cooktown.
Queensland's native police wasn't the first of its kind in Australia, but it was the longest operating. It ran for more than 50 years.
Fundamentally, the goal of the Native Mounted Police was to provide protection to settlers on the frontier.
Europeans were moving into Aboriginal land. They were effectively stealing their land, and Aboriginal people were resisting that.
A lot of the native animals which people used to survive on were no longer there in abundance, and yet here were these cows and sheep that they could hunt, except every time they did, they got in trouble for it.
And that's when the native police would be called in.
The goal was often to move Aboriginal people off the land by whatever means necessary to ensure that European colonisation could take place. And how that was done was through dispersal. And that phrase dispersal has come to be known as a euphemism for we killed or we shot or we murdered the Aboriginal people, we got rid of them. Even in the contemporary documents at the time, when people used the phrase, we disperse the Aboriginals, they use it in inverted commas.
It's totally unequivocal in terms of what their role was. There's only one reason that they were there, to kill Aboriginal people, to basically facilitate the theft of their land.
And remember, most of the people doing this grisly work were Aboriginal men themselves. The native police was run like the military, with detachments. Each detachment was led by a white officer who commanded about 6 or 7 Indigenous troopers, normally from other parts of Australia. This camp here at 8 Mile would have had huts for the troopers, maybe a small house for the white officer, and a big yard for all the horses they used on patrols. But there's one kind of building they've never found.
There are no jails in any of these police camps. There are no lockups. You have a police camp that's there for 20 years. Now, if its role was to arrest Aboriginal people or criminals, why are there no lockups? Why are there no jails? There are no jails because Aboriginal people were not being arrested and brought in and tried. Most Aboriginal people were being shot out on the country and there was no due legal process.
Art Centre's that building down there.
And there's the airstrip.
20 minutes down the road is an Aboriginal community called Hope Vale. We're looking for a man called Anthony Harrigan.
So we might try and find Anthony's house. And if I can't find it, then we'll have to come back and ask at the shop.
But we're in luck.
We've got 2 cars here. That's probably a good sign, I'd like to think.
We've come to see Anthony because he holds important stories about the native police.
This is Georgia.
Hello. Lovely to meet you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm right.
Yep, and nice to see you again, Anthony.
I've been out on country last night.
Katrina said that you just...
On Anthony's country, there are a few sites relating to the native police, but they're quite remote. And because they've had such a huge wet season up here, the rivers are too swollen for us to get there, even in a four-wheel drive. So we sit down for a chat on the front veranda, even though Anthony says it would be much better to talk about this history on country.
We best go out on these sites, you know, where these police camps are, walking, you get the vibes of it, and you got the vibes, and you know what these old Albanian people went through, hardship. You get out on country, you're looking at the old police camp, and you know, you really know that it hits home, then hit base, home base, to tell you what your tribal people went through.
Anthony, who told you all these stories about the police camps?
Well, grandfather took me there when we first got it, Normanby handed back.
Normanby was a cattle station on their traditional country, which the Harrigan families now own.
It's a fairly big property. It's a 31,400 hectare property in white man law, but we go further than that with the rivers and everything.
This is Anthony's cousin, Vince.
My name's Vince Harrigan. I'm a traditional owner for Bulganwara people at Normanby and Battle Camp.
It was their grandfather, Jack Harrigan, who told them about the native police.
Some old grandfather showed me his dad's dad. Old Jack showed me all this. Connection ran the fire. That's where he passed all his history on to me then. Talked and talked about country.
We got told to sit down, and old grandfather, righto, you fellas listen, eh? I'm going to tell you a story about this, what happened. The massacre sites, this is what happened, you know? Righto, oh yeah. All right, you've got that now? Yeah. All right, we go then.
Because on their country, at a place called Battle Camp, the native police massacred their people. It all began in 1872.
Gold, Yellowstone.
Gold was discovered up here on the Palmer River.
When the first settlers came, just chasing the yellow gold, came over invading country then. That's what started all this conflict. Cookton was the gateway to the gold. What they call this here? Cookton, now what? Gateway to the paradise or something. Gateway to the paradise, I think it was a highway to hell. For us.
Here's Linley and Cal.
So in 1873, in October...
October 1873...
an official government expedition arrives at the Endeavour River at what was to become...
Cooktown. Cooktown was not even built yet.
The expedition, which included government officials, gold prospectors and one native police detachment, set off overland.
Up to the Palmer via Normanby River and Battle Camp.
Yeah, so that was a big battle between our mob and the native police, yeah, the troopers.
Some Aborigines come into camp. Some say there were 150 of them. Some say there were less.
They wanted to get rid of all the black fellas.
And the native troopers apparently, in the morning, took them on head-to-head and wiped them all out.
There are multiple written accounts of what happened at Battle Camp. All mention that a large group of Indigenous people were massacred at a lagoon. One account from a miner called William Webb is particularly chilling.
He talked about coming across Aboriginal people and shooting them all at the lagoon.
Any Aboriginal that went to the waterholes stayed at the waterholes.
Meaning that they did not leave the lagoon, they were shot.
It's estimated that at least 80 people were massacred at Battle Camp in 1873.
We shot them for nothing.
Murderers is what, you know, it was.
Up here, stories like the Battle Camp massacre are all too common. Linley has been working with Indigenous communities across Queensland for more than 20 years. And in all those communities, she's heard similar oral histories.
Every Aboriginal community I have ever worked with in Queensland has always talked about a conflict narrative, about colonisation, dispossession of land, the troopers, people being shot, people being taken away by the police. Every community has a narrative of violence and conflict associated with their history.
I only spent 1 week in Queensland, but every Indigenous person I interviewed, from Mount Isa in the far west...
I'm Sian Fogarty, and I've lived here in Mount Isa all my life.
...across to Townsville.
My name is Colin McLennan, and I'm the elder of the Jenga people.
...and up to Hopevale in the far north.
My name is Eric Harrigan. I'm a Lamalama.
Everyone I interviewed told me massacre stories, oral histories they heard from their elders.
There was a massacre there on Lakeville. They were out on a big lake, you know, like they're eating wild rice. They're getting geese eggs and everything. the police had the station owners and that they were in this, involved with this, and they're good on the horse, you know, shooting them.
Hunted down and shot.
They just rounded up anybody.
And there's a place, what they call Murdering Lagoon. Murdered 13 people there, they did.
Like there's a water hole, big water hole in the cliff, and when we would go there, like Grandad and Mick wouldn't sleep at night and have the fire always going, because where we went camping was where, up the top there, and it was where some of the women and kids were shot.
So a lot of people died, yeah? But they didn't kill us all out, huh? So we're still here to be able to talk about those things, yeah?
In Hope Vale, sitting under Anthony Harrigan's veranda, it starts to pour.
Mati. Rain.
Mati. He tells me a second massacre took place on his country at a police camp called Puckley's.
Well, for Puckley's, you know, went there with my grandfather telling me the story, you know.
But unlike the massacre at Battle Camp, there's no written sources, no diaries or letters to back this one up. The story of Puckley's that Anthony and Vince tell is eerily similar to the story of Battle Camp and to some of the other massacre stories you've just heard. Their people were rounded up.
They were hunted down like animals and they were captured, you know, brought back to there and they were shot there.
See the Puckley one, that's where they shot them all there. Every the big old massacre took place there.
And then the bodies were put in a nearby waterhole.
They put them straight down in that big waterhole then.
And it's black.
A blue waterhole, about big as this brand.
That's where they threw all the bodies in there. Kids and all, you know.
Anthony and Vince don't need archival documents to confirm this massacre happened. The oral history their grandfather passed on is real enough for them.
I took my nephew there, I told him, I want to show you something, listen to this. See those people, they get shot all up there, look, shot. I told him, you have a listen. You can hear all the old people in the water. You lay there, you can hear all these kids talking in language.
I can still hear them. Kids crying and a lot of the old people. No one else might hear it, but I can hear them.
Chopsticks. You can hear it all. Because they got shot and that's their spirit. Their spirit is still there today. Singing, talking, quabbling.
One of the hardest things to understand when it comes to the history of the Native Police is the Indigenous Troopers. Why they joined up to the force and what made them stay. So I've come to the Atherton Tablelands in the hills behind Cairns to speak to a woman called Heather Burke.
Oh, look at all the dogs. Hi, I'm Georgia.
Hi, Georgia. I'm Heather.
That's nice to meet you.
That's George.
How many dogs?
Heather's an associate professor of archaeology at Flinders University, and she's also a chief investigator on the Native Mounted Police project alongside Linley and Bryce.
Does that mean you're going to make us coffee?
I'm sure Heather will make you a coffee.
Heather and the rest of the team have read and transcribed more than 10,000 primary documents about the Native Police. But in all those 10,000 documents, there's barely anything about the Aboriginal troopers.
We have no records from any Aboriginal trooper. The Aboriginal troopers are often not named, so we'll know that there might be some officer with seven troopers, but we won't know who those troopers were, we won't know where they came from, we won't know where they went to.
What was the rationale for having Aboriginal people as part of the Native Police?
There's a whole lot of reasons. From the purely economic through to the kind of creepily sociological of using Indigenous people to police other Indigenous people. For one thing, they're cheap, so you don't have to pay them in the same way that you would have to pay white people. The idea was that you're exploiting those existing enmities that might exist between groups. So you're deliberately playing them off against each other. They're both expedient and exploitable and deniable in a way, because if you never give them names, you never know who they are, they can pretty much do what they like.
They were deliberately recruited from areas that were as far away from the area that they were going to be working in. And that has to do with a whole lot of reasons, the idea that they had no kin relationship with the people that they were going to be killing. but also effective distance for desertion. If you're that far away from country, it's going to probably dissuade you from running away. And desertion, of course, was an issue. The desertion rate was fairly high.
They often had trouble getting troopers at all to enlist. So when they had trouble, they'd take them from anywhere they could get them. And often they'd just take them from local settlers, or they'd go to missions and recruit people. So they're already trying to target men who might be vulnerable anyway. So some of them would have been survivors of massacres themselves, and they would have been taken as small children by the native police, because the native police was the institution that was doing a lot of the kidnapping of Aboriginal children after massacres and giving them to settlers, you know, to be domestics or to be pastoral labourers or whatever. But from what we can tell from our research, there are some Aboriginal men who volunteered.
And you have to look at it in the context of a society that had been utterly disrupted, that had loved ones and kin killed, you know, their wives raped and their land taken off them. And so these young men were looking at, well, how do I make something of myself in these new circumstances?
If you yourself are displaced and all the things that you knew and all the normal ways you would have connected to your world are broken, how much can you actually say that person is freely giving their labour to this particular cause? So it's always murky and it's always really messy.
All of this rings true with the stories passed on to Cal Elwood. Her great-great-grandfather, Jack Noble, was an Aboriginal trooper in the Native Police. He's the one who went to Victoria chasing the Kelly gang.
Jack would have been 14 or 15 when the white fella from the Native Police at Rockhampton picked him out from Fraser's Island. White fella come in and said, "You're on now," took him away. He might have just seen shiny buttons because his cousins and that were also Native policemen and they're well fed. So I can't really think of what he was thinking about when he joined or when he was stolen or whatever. It's just, I wasn't there, so I don't know what he thought about. I don't know why he decided or how he decided or what ran through his head when he went through training or what ran through his head when he was shooting blackfellas.
Cal's great-great-grandfather was stationed at Baralga, a native police camp not far from Cooktown. At Baralga, Lindley, Heather and Bryce and the rest of their team did two major archaeological digs.
We've found things like perfume bottles and costume jewellery. So, you know, there were women there. We have children's toys. We find ruled slates, which indicates that perhaps there was some education going on amongst the troopers and their families. It really gives a human face to these troopers, even though they were doing terrible things. It just brings home the complexity, I suppose, of life on the frontier. These were people as well.
And they were people who were doing their best to keep their culture alive. Near the troopers' huts, they found thousands of glass flakes, which tells us that the men and their families were chipping away at, or napping, glass bottles to make spear points or knives.
Here we have, in these police camps, Aboriginal troopers or their wives sitting around perhaps the campfire or just on a log like we are, with their bottle, with a stone hammer in one hand and napping that glass. And that process of napping is something that Aboriginal people have done in this country for at least 65,000 years.
And there was probably no real practical reason for them. These people had knives and European utensils. So when you think about, well, why were they napping bottle glass? Why were they making sharp knives and things? And I think it is maintaining that connection to culture.
I reckon they would have been sitting around their huts or around their fires, gaming, yarning, smoking, you know, riding. Being normal people in extraordinary times.
Many years have passed since Cal first read about the Native Police in her high school library. Since then, she's studied archaeology and history. She's just submitted her PhD on the history of Aboriginal gold miners. And yet, being descended from a trooper in the Native Police is something that Cal and the rest of her family are still trying to make sense of today.
My grandmother's older sister She married a Kukyalanji man. Now, Kukyalanji is the Palmer River Goldfield people. And the native police, so Jack shot their ancestors. They were never told the stories about Jack. They were never told how he come from a native policeman. And it's been quite interesting watching how my own cousins are dealing with this whole idea that their great-great-grandfather shot their other great-great-grandfather. Some don't like it, so they refuse it. And there's others in that side of the family. Jack's a hero because he got Ned Kelly.
So in your family, you have people who survived massacres and a man who helped carry out massacres.
Who did them, not helped to carry out. He did them. Let's not mince words. He did them.
He did them.
He pulled the trigger.
So how do you make sense of it?
If you don't, a lot of tears are shed, a lot of despair. We in the North, we normally say, well, that's the way it is. We can't change it. But you got to think on it.
Like Cal, Vince Harrigan is also still grappling with his history. He's got three kids. They're 8, 5, and 2 years old. In a few years' time, when he thinks they're ready, he'll sit them down on their country, like his grandfather before him, and tell them how the native police killed their people. But there's no anger in his heart towards the Aboriginal troopers in the native police.
You know, it wasn't a very good thing what they did, but I reckon you wouldn't wish that upon anyone. You know, my daddy was both white and black together, you know, and he always said that in the end it wasn't their fault, that was their job. They were made to do it, you know.
About 140 years ago, Cal and Vince's ancestors fought on different sides of the frontier. But now they just want the same thing, for Australia to properly acknowledge this history and how it implicates us all.
You know, it's not all about Cook and Joseph Banks and Burke and Wills and Leichhardt and all them fellas. We're aware about all that stuff, just long as they're aware about what happened with the massacres and all that sort of stuff too. Just needs to be told, I reckon, yeah.
I think we need to talk about it. Recognition that it happened is more than enough for me. Otherwise, why be a historian to bring this sort of stuff to the front? Because we remember it today. It's passed on. It's remembered what was done to us.
It's just got to be told how it is. And that way, then, we move on as a nation, knowing that this is what happened back in the day, you know?
That was part one of our two-part series about Queensland's native police and how Indigenous people connected with this history understand it today. This program was produced by Georgia Moody with sound engineer Tim Simons. Next time, we bring you the story of Indigenous families grappling with huge gaps in their family history. Gaps caused by the violence of the native police. I'm Daniel Browning, and this is The History Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.